I'm going to begin with a kind of a parable of sorts. It was written by Lessing in the 18th century. He was a philosopher, wrote some plays, and updated an account in his play Nathan the Wise. And it really demonstrated the kind of mindset of religious tolerance that was growing during the Enlightenment there, and I think in many ways really matches the same mindset that we see today in our world. Nathan the Wise was a Jewish thinker. There was another character in this play, Saladin, who was a Muslim, and then there was a Christian Templar knight, and it was supposed to be set during the time of the Crusades. Well, Saladin comes to Nathan the Wise, and they're, you know, not quite sure if they trust each other, all these kinds of things. And so Saladin ends up asking Nathan, you're a wise man, so which is the true religion? And Nathan begins to try to think through, how do I answer this? And so he says, okay, let me give you this parable. There was a ring that had a special, you know, beautiful ring, and whoever wore this ring had favor with God and man. And people, this signified the person who was to be the ruler of the family, and so each father would pass it on to the son that he thought would be able to rule best. And one father ended up having this ring, and he had three sons, and he loved each of his sons. And at different times, he promised each of his sons that he would give them the ring. And as he was getting closer to death, he realized, what am I going to do? I promised each of my sons a ring. And so he took this ring to a master jeweler. And he asked the jeweler to make rings just like this. And the jeweler came back and he gave him three rings. And the father couldn't even tell which one was the real one. And so just before he dies, individually he gives each of his sons a ring. Well, after he dies, each of the sons come out saying, well, father gave me the ring, so I'm supposed to lead the family. And all of a sudden they're fighting against each other. And no matter how much they fought, and how much, the way Lessing puts it, the brothers investigate, recriminate, and wrangle, all in vain. Which was the true original genuine ring was undemonstrable. Almost as much as now, by us, is undemonstrable the one true faith. Just like they couldn't tell which ring it was, we can't tell, is it Christianity, is it Islam, is it Judaism? And so they go to a judge, and they say, what are we supposed to do? And the judge says, well, each of you believes that your father promised you the ring and gave you the ring, and so you need to believe that you have the ring. And so the answer to which religion was true was whichever religion you want to hold to. That's the true religion. And as I said, it probably needs to be modified a bit in our day, because now we don't just have three major religions. We have a ton of major religions. And the way that our world thinks is we think, you know, all the religions are basically good. You just got to figure out which religion works for you. And that's perhaps the biggest alternate belief out there in our day. In particular, in light of what traditional historic Christianity has taught. If you would open up to John 14. John 14 in chapter 6. Here, Jesus, talking to his disciples, makes a statement that many in our day kind of almost wish Jesus didn't make. He says this. Jesus said to him, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And that's the traditional understanding of Christianity. A word that's often used to describe it is it's an exclusive belief. That is saying there are some people who aren't part of it. No one comes to the Father except through Jesus. This is the only way. And just so we're aware as we start off, this is not like this is a new thing. Right? This is what Jesus says. You come to one of the first sermons that Peter gives in the book of Acts, in Acts 4, and he stands before the Pharisees, and what does he say? He says, "There is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved." That this is the only name by which we can be saved, the name of Jesus. And Paul in Galatians says, "There's one God and one mediator between God and man, the man Jesus Christ." And John, the disciple of love, the apostle of love, in 1 John says, "He who has the Son has life. He who does not have the Son of God does not have life." That it's not like, you know, several hundred years ago the Christians got around and said, "Hey, what are we going to do about other religions? I know. Let's decide ours is the only true one." But this is what Christians have believed from the very beginning. And yet, many in our day push back against this idea. That they argue for what's often called pluralism. And let me just kind of explain what pluralism is. You have some notes in your handout. You've probably heard this idea before. It's popularized, it's been popularized for a while. Some of the people who have done it, there's a man named Houston Smith, big name in world religion studies. He wrote a book in the 1940s that has been republished multiple times, is now published under the name The World's Religions. And he likes to describe the major religions as different paths up the mountain. You've heard that before, right? Different religions, yeah, they're different paths up the mountain. When you're at the bottom of the mountain, they look like they're really different, right? Because you're on opposite sides of the mountain. But as you get closer to the top, you begin to realize all the paths come together. Because ultimately all of them are pointing to the same goal. They're all leading to the same reality. Right. And not only are religions different paths up a mountain, they're also the same ethically. One of the people among Christianity, broad Christianity, who's really argued for pluralism is a man named John Hick. And one of his big arguments is this. All the major world religions make people better. And so how can you possibly decide which one's the best religion? Because all of them make people better. And so there are good people who are Hindus, there are good people who are Buddhists, there are good people who are Sikhs, there are good people who are Muslims, good people who are Christians, good people who are Jews. All of them are teaching the same thing. And so there's no need to choose one or the other. All of them teaching the same thing. Now, just so you know, this is actually slightly different from something we'll look at in a moment. Because in pluralism, some religions aren't good. Because they don't make you a better person. But any religion that makes you a better person is an equally good religion. Because all these religions are pointing to the same reality. And I've capitalized reality there because it's a thing. This reality is a thing. And it's saying all the religions are pointing to this. And so, one way you put it, you know, God is known to Christians, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs, and others represent different manifestations in relation to humanity. Different faces or masks or personae of God, the ultimate reality. And again, you maybe have heard an illustration that's often used to describe this reality. You ever heard of five blind men who come upon an elephant? Well, they're blind, so they probably like stumble upon, they run into it, and you know, maybe smack into the elephant or something. And they come up with different parts. And the first guy grabs the leg of the elephant, and he says, "Oh, an elephant's like a tree trunk." And someone else grabs the tusk and says, "No, the elephant is hard like a piece of stone." Someone else has the trunk and says, "No, it's like a snake." And someone else has the ear and says, "No, the elephant's like a fan." And someone else has the side and says, "No, it's broad like a wall." And so that's what different religions are. You know, each religion thinks, "Oh, this is what God is," but it's only getting part of God. Because all of them are pointing to the bigger thing, the whole elephant. All of them are pointing to the same reality. And why do people believe in pluralism? What are some of the arguments that are used? Well, one of the big ones is the idea that there's a lot of fighting that happens because of religion. And so if we all just realize all the religions are the same, we'll all get along. You've seen the coexist bumpers, right? That's his mindset. Hey, stop fighting with each other. We all believe the same thing. Let's just get along. then we'll really be able to tolerate each other. And pluralism claims to make sense of what I call the ineffable nature of religious experience. Ineffable is the idea that you can't describe it. And so also part of that is you can't invalidate it. Maybe you've heard this if you talk to someone. Well, my religion works for me. Or I've just found that I think of God this way and it gives me peace or it gives me hope or it gives me comfort. And pluralists would say, well, who are you to say it doesn't? That's their religious experience. And if it's their religious experience, you can't doubt that. You can't say it's wrong. And then as well, pluralism claims to best deal with the religious and cultural diversity of the world. This is from Wilfred Cantwell Smith. He says, "It is morally not possible actually to go out into the world and say to devout, intelligent fellow human beings, we are saved and you are damned. Where we believe that we know God and we are right, you believe that you know God and you're totally wrong." You ever had someone tell you that? Not to tell you I'm right but you're wrong, but you can't say that to anyone. But that's what Christians do, right? I mean, don't Christians go around saying, you know, I'm saved, you're lost. This is the true God and yours isn't. And pluralists say, you realize these are smart people. Who are you to say that? How could you possibly make a claim like that? And that's, I put it this way, that's the air we breathe. That's just the way that we think nowadays. I've been able at Wayne State for the last year and a half to do a worldview quiz we put together based on a book by James Anderson, What's Your Worldview? Put a little PowerPoint quiz together. And it takes you through a series of questions, and you either answer, you know, yes or no, basically. And then that either takes you to a question or a worldview. The most common worldview I come to is pluralism. And very often, when we get there, then every worldview points out some of the problems or tensions in those worldviews. And as I began to walk through this, time after time I hear someone say, well, I'm a Christian, but I can't tell someone else what they need to believe. That's the idea of pluralism. Hey, it works for me, but it may not work for you. And that's fine, because I don't need to make it work for you. You've heard this. Your friends believe this. This is what our world thinks. What are some problems with this idea, though? I mean, it sounds good on one level. But let's really begin to investigate and see, does pluralism really hold up? And the first thing we need to recognize is pluralism doesn't really lead to tolerance. And it doesn't lead to tolerance for two reasons. One, it doesn't lead to tolerance because it's not true. Like, let's say we went over to the Middle East right now and we talked to the leaders of the Islamic State and you said, guys, don't you understand? You believe the same thing as everyone else in the world. What are they going to say? No, we don't. We don't believe the same thing. You know what the pluralists? The pluralist actually has a wishful hope that everyone would believe the same thing. But they don't. And so simply to say, but you all believe the same thing, isn't going to lead to tolerance. It's going to mask the real issues. It's going to mask where potentially we would need to work through some things. But the second reality is pluralism doesn't lead to tolerance. Because often, underlying this idea that pluralism leads to tolerance is the idea that if you think you're right and someone else is wrong, then you won't tolerate that person. So if you really think you're right, then you'll be intolerant. And so you need to kind of be unsure about yourself. You're going to say, well, this is what I believe, but who knows? I mean, I don't really know if I'm right. So now I'm going to tolerate other people. But you know what you have to really know in order to tolerate people? That it's good to tolerate? Like, if you don't know that it's good to tolerate people, you'll never tolerate people. You've got to be certain that it's good to tolerate people. And that, in part, means you have to be certain that humans deserve respect. But as well, the issue really isn't in our certainty of knowledge. Because I may not know if I'm right or not, but still hate you. The problem isn't in my thinking. The problem is in my will and in my heart. And simply telling me, well, you can't be sure what you think isn't going to change that. I need a different solution to deal with the issue of the heart and the will. Secondly, pluralism actually creates a new religion. And just kind of as an example of this, it's interesting. We tend in our day to think about Hinduism as a very inclusive religion, as opposed to exclusive. Remember, exclusive is like, you know, this is the way and there aren't other ways. People say, well, Hinduism isn't like that. You know, Hinduism is just, hey, everyone really believes the same thing. But you know what Hinduism actually believes? Everything is Hinduism. That is, if you talk to a Hindu and you say, you know, I believe in Jesus, like, well, I believe in Jesus too. What do you believe about Jesus? Well, I believe Jesus teaches the truth of the Vedas, which is the Hindu scriptures. And so they actually don't believe that, oh, all the religions are the same. They believe all the religions are like this. Well, pluralism basically says all of the religions aren't actually like any of what they claim to be. All of them actually are like this new religion I've created. Let me explain how that works, right? First of all, it changes the idea of God. That you guys, most of you, are pretty familiar with the idea of God in Christianity, right? And as you describe God in Christianity, you're going to say he's a personal God. There's only one God. He's immaterial. He's a good God. He knows everything. He's separate from creation. You talk to one of the main schools of Hindu thought, and they're going to say the ultimate reality is Brahman. And Brahman is impersonal. And Brahman is neither good nor evil. And you talk to Muslims, and they're going to say there's one God, but he's not a trinity. It's the soul unity. And he doesn't really interact with creation. He created the world, but he's so above it. He doesn't really interact with it. You talk to Buddhists, and some Buddhists are going to say there really is no God. There is no ultimate reality. And then the pluralist comes along and says, well, all of you are actually talking about this thing over here. You're all talking about the real. And the real is this thing that's beyond categories. It's neither personal nor impersonal. Because Christians say God's personal, Muslims say God's personal, Hindus say God's impersonal. Well, the real is neither personal nor impersonal. It's neither good nor evil. And you're like, well, that doesn't sound at all like the God I'm talking about. And the answer is, well, it's not. It's a different God. And the pluralist comes along and says, well, all of you really believe this. But this runs into problems too. Because it says, well, the real is neither personal nor impersonal. It's neither good nor evil. Well, what is it then? And you'll find if you begin to talk to people about this, that they basically say, well, you can't describe it. But this thing that we can't describe is the basis of everything in the world. And when you talk about God, you're talking about this thing. Well, I thought you said you can't describe it. Oh, yeah. There's this contradiction. Right? All these gods are this. But you can't describe this God. Oh, yeah. I forgot. And really, when it comes down to it, if I said, you know what, that's the basis of everything? This thing that we don't know anything about. That's really no different than me saying, there's nothing at the basis of everything. It's a non-concept. And so pluralism ends up coming with this idea that actually makes no sense. And it actually changes the goal of religions. Remember I mentioned John Hick? And he said, well, all religions make people better. But if someone asked you, what's the goal of Christianity? Would you say, well, the goal of Christianity is to make people better people? I hope you wouldn't. Because that's not the goal of Christianity. What's the goal of Christianity? What is eternal life? To know God. That's the goal of Christianity. Now, do other religions get us there? Not if they don't know God. And so you've got to come along and say, well, that's what you think Christianity is really all about. You know what Christianity is really all about? Making you a better person. Oh, I didn't realize that. No one in Christianity ever taught me that. That's because it's not what Christianity teaches, it's what pluralism teaches. It's its own religion that creates its own goal. And pluralism ignores the law of non-contradiction. Right. Now I know you guys are tired. Stay with me here. Pluralism says all religions are the same. Let me just briefly explain Christianity versus Theravada Buddhism. We talked about this last night. Christianity, what's at the heart of Christianity is the fact that there's a God who made the world, and the world's broken because of sin. And so Jesus has to come to pay for our sins to make us right with God, right? You know that. And Theravada Buddhism says, there is no God, but the world is wrong because we want impermanent things to be permanent. And so the world is full of suffering because we try to latch on to things that really are not permanent because we actually don't have a soul. There's no self. There's no I. And I think there's an I. I think there's a self. I think there's a soul. And so I tend to want things for that soul. And that creates suffering and that keeps me in the world. And so I've got to understand that I don't exist and to become detached from the world. Now, do those sound like the same thing? Those are very different things. And the law of non-contradiction says this. A can't be both A and not A. And this is one of those laws that is a law of logic that you can't avoid. Because as soon as you say it doesn't exist, you have to use it to argue that it doesn't exist. And pluralism says Buddhism is Buddhism and not Buddhism at the same time. And so you can't have, in Christianity and Buddhism, they can't both be right. They could both be wrong. One could be right and one could be wrong, but they can't both be right because they're different. They're contradictory belief systems, right? And the final thing is this, and this is probably the biggest one I want you to get. Because typically, when someone says, I'm a pluralist, they're wanting to say, you know what, who am I to say which religion is true? You know, I'm not going to make any kind of big claims like that. All the religions are true. Right? Let's think for a moment. This illustration of the elephant. So a pluralist is going to come along and say, you know, all the different religions, they've all got part of the truth. But how does that picture work? You want to know how you know that each religion only has part of the truth? You're not blind. Right? The only way you know that each of those blind people only have part of the elephant is because you're not blind. You see the whole elephant. And that's why you're able to say, hey, all of you guys just get part of the truth. You don't have all the truth? I do. And that's how I know you guys don't have all the truth. All the religions are, you know, no religion's better than another. How do you know that? Well, because I actually happen to know what's true. You say, well, I don't know what's true. You know what you can't say then? All the religions are the same. Because you don't know. If you don't have the truth, you can't make a claim about the truth. And so when you step up and you say, all the religions are basically the same, you're saying, I have insight into reality that no other religion has. That's a massive truth claim. And you know what I tell people? I would never make a claim like that. I don't have enough confidence in myself to make a claim like that. You know what the claim I make is? God has the truth. If you think about it this way, the elephant spoke. That I wasn't left trying to find it. The elephant spoke to me. And that's really where I think we're understanding when Jesus says, I'm the way, and we're beginning to recognize that there aren't multiple ways. But what about this question where Jesus says, I am the truth? Because for some people, they aren't pluralists. They're actually what we would call relativists. So a pluralist says, all religions, they're just different paths up the same mountain. You know what a relativist says? Each religion is its own mountain. And so Buddhism is true for Buddhists. And Christianity is true for Christians. And Islam is true for Muslims. And Hinduism is true for Hindus. And they're relativists because there's no standard to which you can compare everything. That all you can do is compare Buddhism within Buddhism. Or Christianity within Christianity. There's no standard between them. And we talked a little bit this morning about moral relativism. And we pointed out that no one's really a moral relativist. And the reason is largely because relativism just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And it doesn't work for a few reasons. Relativism is what's called a self-defeating philosophy. Because here's the heart of relativism. There are no absolute truths. And what do you say to that?
Absolutely sure.
Yeah, is that true? Is that true for everyone? Well, then it's false, right? Because there is an absolute truth. And that's what we mean by the self-defeating philosophy. At the very heart of what it claims, it undermines itself. And really, no one wants to believe relativism, in part because, like we talked about this morning, so you say, well, all religions are really the same. It's okay. How many of you ever heard, you probably haven't, the Family of God? Right? The Family of God was a cult that arose in the 60s. It was called, I think, the Jesus people at that time, or the Children of God. And it was called the Children of God, now it's called the Family. That's what it is. All right. Now, in this religion, they teach that everyone's part of one big family. And that they demonstrate love for each other by having sex with each other. And they do that, they're all families, they're all brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles, and they've done that with, like, you know, you have to be at least 12 to begin participating. And then as well, they get money by what they call flirty fishing, where young, attractive women will find wealthy people and sleep with them in exchange for money to be given, which is like prostitution, right? But that's what their religion is. And so you say, you know what, that's just as getting good as any other religion, though. You say, well, no, that's not as good. I was like, that's not as good as Buddhism. You know what he just said? You're not a relativist. Because if you're a relativist, you can't say that. Mm-hmm. Because the only way you can say that is if there's a standard above religion. And the moment you say, well, one religion's not as good as others, you've now allowed the opportunity for me to say, well, one religion is better than all the others. Because if you're really a relativist, that means that it's equally valid for me to demonstrate my religious beliefs by running into an orphanage with a bomb strapped to myself to blow myself up as it is to start an orphanage. That those are equally valid expressions of my religious faith. And we're like, No, those aren't equally valid religions of expressions of faith. Well, then you're not a relativist. At least not a consistent relativist. And so some may begin to argue with relativism, but they don't really believe it. And let me deal with a few more objections that you might face as you come up with and interact with people like this. That there are a lot of people who are going to say, Ben, you realize how arrogant you sound right now? I mean, you're saying you're right and someone else is wrong. But that was what the Koi said, right? How could you possibly go to someone who's intelligent and say, I know God and you don't? I mean, how arrogant is that? Well, first of all, I want you to understand that's not an argument. That's ad hominem. You know what ad hominem is? That's attacking the person. You said nothing about my claim of truth. All you said is you're a jerk. And so potentially you say, okay, fine, I'm an arrogant jerk, but is it right? That's the issue. Yeah. The question isn't am I arrogant, the question is it right? But I want to push back a little bit more. Certainly, there are some people who are very arrogant when they talk about having the truth. But the person who just said it's arrogant to claim to know the truth, you know what they just said? A truth claim.
Were they arrogant when they said that? So something, you know, you're kind of arrogant if you say you have the truth. So you're being arrogant right now? Well, no, I'm not. Okay, so it's possible to say you have the truth without being arrogant. And so it's not arrogant to say you have the truth. It might be arrogant, but it doesn't have to be arrogant. What about this? You can believe what you want. Just don't try to push your view on others. I mean, I've heard that. You've heard that, right? And at first we're kind of like, oh, yeah, I mean, I don't want to push my view on other people. But let's think about that for a moment, right? The person who's telling you that, all right? So you believe Christianity is true, and you believe that part of what Christianity means is you need to tell other people that Christianity is true. And that's what Jesus told you to do, right? And this person says, no, you shouldn't ever try to convince someone else of what you believe. So what do they believe? They believe that you should never try to tell anyone else what to believe. And what are they doing? Telling you to believe what they believe. You know, if they really believe you should never tell anyone else what to believe, what would they do? Shut up. Because then they would never express that. Because the moment they begin to express it, they're denying what they claim to believe. The problem isn't telling someone else what you believe. The problem is they don't like what you believe. Mm-hmm. And they want you to believe what they believe. And you say, I understand that, but I don't like what you believe. And so we're both doing the same thing. If it's okay for you to do it, it's okay for me to do it.
What about this? It's not loving to tell others only Jesus can save them. I remember I was in a discussion one time with an atheist, and he was basically expressing, you know, you can believe whatever you want. Just don't tell me I'm going to go to hell because I don't believe what you believe. Right? This wasn't directed at me. This was kind of directed to the audience. Right? And so it comes to my turn to speak. And I said, you know, I understand that. I mean, I can't imagine ever telling someone else they're going to go to hell unless it was true. And then I can't imagine not telling someone that. So to say it's not loving to tell someone else that only Jesus saves them only makes sense if Jesus isn't the only way to save them. Think about it this way. Let's say you have some kind of growth on your body. And I say, you know, I think you need to get that checked out. I think it's cancerous. Let's say you go to the doctor and they check it out and they say, yeah, this is a malignant tumor. And you say, I think I'll be okay. And I say, look, I really think you need to get this treated. Like, I go to another doctor, have them check it out. I'm just telling you, this could kill you. You need to check this out. You need to get this treated. And when you say, hey, I thought you cared about me. Now, probably it would be wrong if I, like, drugged you at night and, like, dragged you into the hospital and signed you up for chemo, right? Like, you'd say, Ben, that's overboard, right? And I would agree. And if that's how we're doing evangelism, we need to stop. But if we're doing evangelism by saying, here's the truth. Consider this reality. I'm urging you. I'm pleading with you. I'm begging you. Jesus is the only way for salvation. I'm convinced of this. And I'm concerned for your well-being. But it would be horribly unloving not to do that.
What about this? Religious beliefs are just culturally conditioned.
You want Ben? If you were born in Pakistan, you wouldn't be a Christian. And you know, they may be right. I mean, on one level, obviously, one of the reasons I'm a Christian is because of where I was born and the interactions I had. Now, again, I want you to understand something. That's actually a flawed argument. The flawed argument is called the genetic fallacy. The genetic fallacy says, because of where the idea came from, it can't be valid. But that's not necessarily true. It doesn't matter how you got the idea.
What matters is whether it's true. Now, it might matter as to whether or not you have a good reason to believe it, but it doesn't change whether or not it's true. But secondly, you realize the person who's saying that only thinks what they think because they're born in the West? That the pluralist is a pluralist because of where he was born. You say, does that mean that pluralism is false? Like, is Islam actually true? Do you think that pluralism and relativism are true? Well, you realize the only reason you think that is because of where you were born. And if that doesn't change the truth, then it doesn't change the truth to you as a Christian either. The fact that you were born to a Christian family doesn't mean that Christianity is not true. That's a flawed argument. So, where does that leave us? If pluralism doesn't work, relativism doesn't work, then why would we choose Christianity? And I probably haven't been quite as clear on this as I would like to, but let me just make sure I'm making this statement now. People want to say, I don't want to hold an exclusive belief. But do you realize everyone ultimately holds exclusive beliefs? Mm-hmm. Because eventually, no matter what you believe, you're going to be forced to someone who disagrees with you to say, we don't agree. You're not part of the same thing. And actually, a couple of summers ago, I thought this came up pretty strongly. Some of you may remember this. World Vision, maybe you've heard about this. They're a massive Christian charity organization. And a couple of years ago, they came out with saying, we're going to now start allowing our members to have gay marriages. And the Christian evangelicals started rising up and saying, you can't do this, we're going to pull your support. So they ended up reversing their decision. And essentially what happened was, evangelical Christians said that this kind of belief, the belief that gay marriage is acceptable biblically, is outside of the bounds of what we believe is valid Christianity. At that exact same time, the new CEO of Mozilla Firefox came under fire because this was 2014, I think. So it's about 6 years earlier, in 2008, when I think Proposition 8 in California was being passed. It was the law that was defining marriages between one man and one woman, and he donated to it. And so he becomes CEO. That comes to light, and there's a major uproar of people saying, we don't want someone like this serving as the CEO of Mozilla Firefox, and so they fired him. And you realize what was happening there is both groups were saying, there are certain things we think are out of bounds. Not because they're different in that. One group tends to be viewed as very inclusive. The other group tends to be viewed as very exclusive. But both of them are actually exclusive. Both of them ultimately say there are some things that aren't valid. So if everyone's exclusive, then can we find a belief that allows for the greatest amount of love and tolerance to those on the outside? And I think we can. I think Christianity, which is really where I'd say Jesus is not only the way, he's not only the truth, but he's the life. And he's the life in this way. He's the life in that Jesus Christ actually lived and died and rose again. And often we act as if, well, choosing between religions is like trying to decide, well, which is better, Coke or Pepsi? And it's like, well, how are you supposed to figure that out? Well, that's not how religions work. That we're not just talking about people's opinions. We're talking about what happened in history. You know what happened in history? Jesus rose from the dead. Muhammad didn't do that. Buddha didn't do that. None of the Hindu avatars did that. Jesus did that. Secondly, Jesus is unique. It's interesting, John Hick, the guy I mentioned earlier, he basically said, if Jesus really is what historic Christianity says, then pluralism can't be true. You don't know why? Because who's Jesus? He's God in human flesh. Well, if that's true, then we know who God is. Jesus revealed God to us.
in a way that no one else ever revealed God to us. I had a Muslim ask me one time, why don't you accept Muhammad as a prophet? And I said, because Jesus is God's son. Jesus is the son of God. And so we weren't waiting for some revelation that Muhammad had to bring us. Jesus gave us the full and final revelation of God. And if that's true, then Christianity is set apart from all other religions. And as well, there's a uniqueness of salvation. And this is really tied in with the last one a little bit too. Do you realize that Jesus was really God, and Jesus really died for our sins? It's like, well, how could other religions be valid? Like, why would God say, well, you know, all of you could make it if you just kind of follow the Noble Eightfold Path, but some of you, I'm gonna have my son die for you. Like, whoa, like, so there's another way, and yet Jesus had to die? That makes no sense, because what did Jesus say? If it's at all possible, let this cup pass from me. But it wasn't possible. There was no other way to deal with sin. But part of the reason there's no other way to deal with sin is what we talked about last night. That we can't deal with sin on our own. Someone has to come outside of us to deal with sin. And in Christianity, we have a religion that's not based on us. It's based on God. That in Christianity, unlike other religions, you don't say, I get to heaven because I'm good. That we don't say in Christianity, because I'm good, God will accept me. We say, God has accepted me even though I'm not good. And because God has accepted me, now I want to strive to please Him. I want to strive to honor Him. But my salvation is not based on me. Which means that as a Christian, remember that, well, you know, different religions make people better. As a Christian, I'm like, you know what? I understand that. I think, honestly, it's hard to measure. If you were to ask me, on a whole, are actually born-again Christians better people than non-born-again Christians? I think yes. That's really hard to measure. But the more important thing is this. Born-again Christians are better than they would be if they weren't born again. But non-born-again Christians might be better than born-again Christians. Because I'm not a Christian because I'm good. I'm a Christian in spite of the fact that I'm not good. And so I don't have to worry. Other people's goodness is not a threat to me. Because I'm not in competition with them. Because none of us are ultimately good. Only Jesus is ultimately good. And as well, just to go back a little bit to the idea of the mountain, I'd say it this way. You know, not all paths actually lead up to the top of a mountain. I've never climbed a Mount Everest, but you know, one of the things that if you start doing, you know, some of those mountain climbings, they say you need to get, like, a guide, you need to get some maps, because it's easy to get lost. And so, you might find a path that looks like it's going to get you there, but it doesn't. You know what you need? You need someone from the top to come down and say, this is the way up. And that's what Jesus did. Jesus came from God and said, this is who God is. This is how we get there. I am the way, the truth, and the life. And Christianity is different because Christianity changes us from the inside out. It transforms our hearts, which is really our ultimate need. And the final thing that I think helps us to see that Christianity is the life is at the very heart of Christianity is a God who died for His enemies. You say, as a Christian, you know, let's say, so this idea, as a Christian, you come and you say, I'm saved and you're damned, and I know God and you don't. And I think if you have an arrogant attitude when you say that, you know what you haven't grasped yet? Christianity.
Because if you really understand Christianity, then you realize, I'm a horrible lost sinner. And so when I go and tell someone else,
I don't go and say, you know what? I found the truth. Let me enlighten all of you. And you go and say, you know what? All of us are hopelessly lost. And all of us deserve God's wrath. But you know what's amazing? God didn't wipe us out. In fact, He died for us. And this is who I claim to follow. So how should I treat those who believe differently from me? I've got to love them just like God loved me. I've got to love my enemies. Because that's the example Jesus set out for me.
And if I really understand Christianity, then that actually leads to, the way I've heard it put, it's the most inclusive, exclusive belief there is.
And it's the most inclusive in part because of this. Salvation is available for anyone. There's no one who cannot be saved. You don't have to be a Jew. You don't have to do certain practices. You don't have to be part of a certain family. You don't have to be smart enough. You don't have to be good enough. You don't have to be anything but lost. And that's what all of us are. All you have to do is believe. And all of us can do that. Yes, the path is narrow, but it's not narrow because people can't get on it. It's narrow because people don't get on it. It's wide open for everyone. And it's so inclusive because when we look at the history of Christianity, we actually see an incredible amount of inclusivity. Let me just briefly illustrate that from the beginning of Christian history. You realize that the Roman and Greek religions were much like the pluralism of our day. They had multiple gods. And they had no problem with Christians coming up and saying, hey, we want a temple to our God too. Sure, set it there right next to Diana. Put it there right next to Zeus. And they got upset because the Christians were saying, no, you understand. Jesus is the only Lord. That's what bothered them. But you know what the Romans and the Greeks said? These Christians, we abandon our babies at the outside of the cities because we don't want them. You know what they do? They come and pick them up. But there are plagues, and everyone's running out of the city so that they don't catch the sickness, and the Christians are going into the city to care for the sick and the suffering. And why? Because we serve a Savior who died for us, who hated Him, who died for His enemies. And when we believe that, that causes us to be loving to those who differ from us.